this International Commission of Inquiry was inspired by the petition of Paul Robeson and William Paterson, who in 1951 filed a petition at the United Nations entitled "We Charge Genocide in the Crimes of the U.S. Government Against the Negro People."
On April 27, 2021, the International Commission of Inquiry on Systematic Racist Police Violence in the United States released a report featuring weeks of live hearings of cases of people of African descent killed by the police.
We assembled a team of 12 experts, commissioners, none of whom are from the United States, to conduct the investigations in an independent and impartial manner.
We hear from Colette Flanagan with Mothers Against Police Brutality, steering committee members, the Commission of Inquiry organizers, including legal experts Lennox Hines, Felonise Floyd, brother of George Floyd, and other bereaved families who have been fighting for justice.
We all have to work toward each other, and that our humanity bonds us beyond borders. This George Floyd Policing Act that we're pushing here in the United States, it's blood on that bill.
And we will hear from three esteemed elders and survivors of the Black Wall Street Massacre in Tulsa, Oklahoma in 1921, as they testified to Congress 100 years later.
I'm a survivor of the Tulsa Race Massacre. 2 weeks ago, I celebrated my 107th birthday.
Miss Viola Fletcher, 107 years old, and her brother, Mr. Hughes Van Ellis, 100 years old, and Miss Leslie Benningfield Randall, 106, lived to tell the story. From Pacifica Radio, this is COVID, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by Pacifica Radio stations and its affiliates. I'm Akua Holt. 1 year ago, the world shifted instantly after viewing the horrific video of Minneapolis officer Derek Chauvin violating George Floyd's humanity while bystanders watched in shock. In his final moments, George Floyd called for his deceased mother, Sissy. Black Lives Matter and other social justice organizations worldwide took over the streets, creating one of the biggest social justice movements since the civil rights era. After the guilty verdict of Derek Chauvin, attorney Benjamin Crump held a press conference on the campus of Texas Southern University in Houston, Texas.
Good morning, I'm attorney Ben Crump. I am here along with Congresswoman Sheila Jackson Lee and Congressman Al Green. We're standing with the brother of George Floyd, Rodney Floyd, and the nephew of George Floyd, Brandon Williams. And we're coming to talk about how significant it was that the Department of Justice, under the direction of Attorney General Merrick Garland, brought federal criminal civil rights charges against the police officers in the killing of George Floyd. It is appropriate that we're here at the edge of CUNY Holmes Apartments, where George was born and bred, on the campus of Texas Southern University, at their commencement, talking about the hope for the future, because we believe that these charges that were brought by the Justice Department encourages future generations to know that our Department of Justice will be here to make sure that all of American citizens are afforded the constitutional rights of life and liberty and equal justice. The fact that George Floyd's family was very grateful when Attorney General Merrick Garland called them to notify them, Congresswoman, that they were bringing these indictments for the criminal civil rights against those officers for what they did to George Floyd. And it was very evident the first time you watched that video that they had violated the constitutional rights of George Floyd, because at the very basis of our Constitution is the promise of constitutional rights to life and liberty and the pursuit of happiness. And you knew watching that video that they had violated George Floyd's constitutional right to life when they prevented him from taking a breath for 9 minutes and 29 seconds while those officers kept their knee on his neck and on his back. When you think about this indictment, you think not just about George Floyd, but you think about the message this sends to other marginalized minorities who believe they were denied their due process, that they were denied their day in court. People like the family of Eric Garner, people like the family of Breonna Taylor, and people like the family of Andrew Brown in Elizabeth City, North Carolina, who right now are battling with local officials to be transparent, to give them their due process and release the video of why he was shot in the back of the brain going away from the police. That's what this action by the Department of Justice means. It means that the Department of Justice is harkening back to the historical times when it was only the federal intervention that gave marginalized minorities, especially black people, protection that their constitutional rights would be respected.
Attorney Benjamin Crump. The report of the International Commission of Inquiry on Systematic Racist Police Violence Against People of African Descent in the United States press conference was streamed on April 27, 2021, featuring testimonies of family members who have lost loved ones at the hands of police violence, including Philonise Floyd, Colette Flanagan of Mothers Against Police Brutality, and Gwen Carr, mother of Eric Garner.
In June 2020, an international coalition of hundreds of organizations and individuals sent a communication to the United Nations Human Rights Council urging that the UN convene a commission of inquiry to investigate racism and racist police violence in the United States. In an unprecedented move, the UN's African group, which comprises 54 countries from the African continent, supported the efforts of the activists and issues its own call for a commission of inquiry in a draft resolution. The U.S. pushed back against the efforts and the Human Rights Council declined the request. Following the U.N.'s decision to not convene a commission of inquiry, the National Conference of Black Lawyers, the National Lawyers Guild, and the International Association of Democratic Lawyers decided to convene a commission of inquiry to conduct the thorough and impartial investigation of police violence in the United States that the community had demanded. The Commission of Inquiry's mandate was to investigate the systemic, widespread, and grave violations of the rights of Black people by police in the United States and present its findings and recommendations in a report. We assembled a team of 12 experts, commissioners, none of whom are from the United States, to conduct the investigations in an independent and impartial manner. We conducted live hearings where the commissioners heard testimony from the family members of victims of police violence, testimony from lawyers who represent the families of victims, and testimony from community activists. The commissioners also reviewed reports, legislation, and other relevant materials. After the hearings concluded, the commissioners made their findings and recommendations, and a team of rapporteurs compiled the information into a report. That report was released to the general public. Today, our commissioners and one of our rapporteurs will present the findings and recommendations at this press conference. Before we move to that, we want to lift up the voices of a few family members whose loved ones were murdered by police. These are a few of the courageous, fierce people who gave testimony for the Commission of Inquiry. First is Colette Flanagan, founder of Mothers Against Police Brutality. Her son, Clinton Allen, was murdered by the police.
Thank you, Carrie. It's a pleasure to be here today with this esteemed panel in support of this Commission of Inquiry report, highlighting systemic racist police violence against people of African descent in the United States. I started Mothers Against Police Brutality because the Dallas police killed my only son, Clinton Allen, in 2013. Clinton was only 25 years old. He was an unarmed Black man, shot 7 times, 5 times in his chest, once in his upper left right arm and one close range shot in his back. MAPD works from a unique perspective, from a perspective that gives us the lived experience through the lens of mothers and family members who have lost their children and loved ones to police violence in the United States. And when you work from this lived experience, from this lens of losing a child or a loved one to police violence, you have the opportunity to see and understand the impact and devastation that most never see. MAPD upholds the many, many victims that you've never heard of because their egregious deaths did not make the national news. As horrific and egregious police killings that we are currently witnessing, even after George Floyd's horrific death, it's only a minuscule of actual police killings reported from the 18,000 police departments in the United States, because the U.S. federal government does not track this data. In fact, there is a Derek Chauvin in every police department, and some have many Derek Chauvins, as we know by the evidence of the continual killing of Black men and women at the hands of police, which is almost a daily occurrence. Last week, as we were awaiting the Chauvin verdict, just 30 minutes prior to the verdict, the Ohio police killed a 16-year-old Black girl, Micaiah Bryant. 16-year-old Micaiah was shot 4 times. And I think the question we should be asking ourselves, why would a policeman shoot a child 4 times? Or even if he thought she was an adult female, was that really necessary? Would that policeman have seen Micaiah as a threat if she looked like his sister or his aunt or his child or even his mother? Could he have shot someone 4 times that looked familiar to him? I think not. When did this officer no longer see Micaiah as a threat? Was it after the first shot, the second shot, the third shot, the fourth shot? And this current U.S. police culture that trains policemen to eliminate the threat and not to escalate, it's a deadly policy that is costing more and more Black lives daily. It doesn't matter if there are 100 policies to de-escalate when you have a culture of systemic racism deeply seated and rooted in your police department, as in the United States, those policies just do not work. When police departments are still insisting that policemen, when caught on camera using unnecessary deadly force, are merely just a few bad apples, we are way past a few bad apples. We are into orchards of bad apples with trees that have diseased roots tainted with racism and white supremacy, and they are bearing rotten fruit. This is why the work of the civil society-led initiative organized by the National Conference of Black Lawyers, the International Association of Democratic Lawyers, and the National Lawyers Guild is so important. And I want to thank the eminent jurist who heard testimonies from many family members of victims of police brutality, including myself. Their report is an important contribution to recent efforts to hold the United States accountable and directly support the demand we made last summer jointly with the ACLU and other groups to the UN Human Rights, to the UN Human Rights Council to create an independent commission of inquiry to look into racist police killings in the United States. We hope that the UN High Commissioner's report, which is expected this June, will support our demand to create an effective accountability mechanism into law enforcement killings, especially of Black men and women. I strongly believe that a robust international accountability mechanism would further support and complement, not undermine, efforts to dismantle systemic racism in the United States, including by the Biden administration. In closing, I would strongly encourage every commissioner from every state, from every city, from every parish, from every hamlet, and from every jurisdiction to support this Commission of Inquiry report. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Colette. Thank you. Next is Mr. Philonis Floyd, whose brother George was murdered by the police.
Hello, everyone. As you all know, my brother George Floyd was murdered by Derek Chauvin in Minneapolis on May 25th, 2020. For the first time in recent American history that an officer was charged for killing an unarmed Black man. And it was guilty, guilty, guilty. People all around the world, they joined us and celebrated the victory because it was a day that we thought was filled up like celebration. For a moment, we actually thought that Black lives had mattered. It took time for us to reflect, and I just think about Dante Wright and how we had to plan and attend his funeral to be support for him and his family. Basically, it's getting to me now because I'm thinking about everything that's going on. Y'all know how I feel about everything. We have to continue to fight for systemic change. I just want to thank everybody from protesters, like the International Commission of Inquiry. I'm happy that you all just gave me the opportunity to be here and speak. Not just speaking for George, I'm speaking for everybody around the world because justice for George, to me, it means freedom for all. I want to talk about like different things like the violence in the United States and the commissioners from all around the globe, the world, who listen to what happened to my brother and listen to what happened to others all across this world and who have taken action like to condemn human rights abuse and recommend like social change. I want to thank the commissioners for recognizing my humanity as a good Black man in America and for recognizing my brother George Floyd's humanity and the humanity of other families across this nation and bringing the light and acknowledging the United States government is perpetrating crimes against humanity, against Black people in the United States. I want my brothers and sisters to all around this globe to be understanding and reminded that we are our brothers and sisters' keepers. We have great social responsibility that we all have to work toward each other and that our humanity bonds us beyond borders. I want to thank the commissioners from around the globe for accepting the greatness of everybody around here and convening the commission and for acknowledging that the murder of my brother George Floyd is a part of a pattern that crimes against humanity being committed against Black people, against my people in America. Every day I think about people all around this world and I think about how we live in fear of police officers. And I think about how I spoke to many families and had to console them and comfort them and let them know that I hope everything is going to be okay because I can't make it okay for them. But I try to give them the understanding of I've been here before and I know what I'm going through and I know what you all are going through. The hardest part of all of it is trying to talk to a mother who lost their child because I'm just a brother. Even though I have that love, but I don't have the love that a mother has because a mother can heal a child without medicine because they have a different love. They have a unique bond. I just want to thank you all for giving me the opportunity to be able to submit a message to the world and get out this George Floyd Policing Act that we're pushing here in the United States. It's blood on that bill, and everybody from Ahmaud Arbery, Eric Garner, George Floyd, Sandra Bland, Philando Castile, there's so many people who didn't even have footage that are on that bill. And I want to thank you all for giving me this opportunity and this blessing to open up and speak to you all. Because every time you all drop one tear looking at George Floyd, I drop 2 to 3. Thank you all so much.
Thank you so much, Philonis. Thank you. We really appreciate you being here.
Thank you so much.
We have, thanks, this is Gwen Carr, whose son, Eric Garner, was murdered by the police.
As you all know, my son Eric Garner was murdered almost 7 years ago on the streets in New York. He said, "I can't breathe," 11 times, and the police officers, they decided to take his life anyway. And since that time, I've been out here advocating for justice, not only justice for my son, but justice for everyone's son, for the unborn, for my grands, for I'm just so sympathetic in the Black and brown communities because this is where they come in, brutalized, terrorized, and they confront us for no apparent reason. It all gets swept under the rug. Since my son's murder, I said, this is not going to happen no more, not on my watch, if there's anything that I can do about it. That's why I've been traveling around the nation, trying to advocate, speak, and step up where I can. Even as we speak, I'm in North Carolina trying to advocate for Andrew Brown, who was shot in the back of the head, execution style. This just keeps happening. I was so elated about the George Floyd trial that the verdict came back positive on all three counts. The same time that we were getting the verdict, our brothers were being murdered. Although we knew that there was a lot of work that we would have to do, even though we got a positive verdict for George Floyd. But we know that that was one verdict, but that verdict, it was a little bit of victory for us all. We can't stop. And we can see that now because there's been four or five murders since the George Floyd verdict. In my opinion, it's revenge because of the verdict. And we just cannot have officers going around taking our lives at will. This does not happen in the white communities. In the white communities, you never hear of Black police officers shooting down white children or white people. So why do they do that to us? That's why we have to get bills passed, which I have gotten several bills passed in the past, the Eric Garner anti-chokehold bill. I've got the 50A law passed and the Safer New York Act passed. There's no good in passing laws if they're not enforced. And with the 50A, they tried to overturn it. That's why you can't rest. Just because there's a bill passed, that don't mean that it's going to be written in stone. The police, they will try to overturn it. So you got to be very watchful. We can't all watch by ourselves. We need all the communities to watch. We need all the communities to come together. And with that said, it's just not enough being done, I don't think. Because when we take one step forward, look like they push us two steps back. I just want to hear one time that everybody is on one accord, which we know that's going to take a lot to do that. I am so glad to be on this panel so we can hear the different opinions and the different triumphs of different families and different community leaders. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Ms. Carr. Colette Filonis, Ms. Carr.
You just heard from Filonis Floyd, Colette Flanagan of Mothers Against Police Brutality, and Gwen Carr, mother of Eric Garner.
Yeah, imagine living like a Black man. Yo, a Black man in America, sorta kinda like being treated just like a terrorist. Living how I'm living, it's really no comparisons. They systematically trying to kill us, now that's the scariest. I swear the numbers getting various, I'm feeling like I'm Harriet. An underground soldier for my people that I'm carrying. They killed George Floyd, now I'm trying to fill the void. This the life my brother's living, it's really hard to avoid. I keep my hoodie on for Trayvon, I do it for my day ones. Sandra Bland spoke about the path that we should stay on. I can't breathe through this nonsense. The killings coming constant. The crooked politicians is never willing to stop this. Yeah, Breonna Taylor, say her name, say it again. Breonna Taylor, say her name until we win. I pray to God daily, deliver me from my sin. Trying to start a revolution, and here is where we begin. Yeah, if you want some change, you gotta model it. What else? Yeah, speak about your feelings, never bottle it.
Let's talk about
yeah,
it.
Try to do it peaceful, shout to Kaepernick. I really hate the fact that black lives not mattering. It's time to shift the narrative. I'm switching up the pattern. Yeah, it's a pandemic and racial wars that I'm battling.
This is COVID, Race, and Democracy. I'm Akua Holt. The United Nations Human Rights Council, HRC, strongly condemned the continuing racially discriminatory and violent practices perpetuated by law enforcement agencies against African Americans and people of African descent, noting in particular the death of George Floyd and the deaths of other people of African descent. Attorney Lennox Hines, one of the conveners of the International Commission of Inquiry on Systematic Racist Police Violence Against People of African Descent in the United States, press conference explains.
On behalf of the steering committee of this international commission, we'd like to thank and extend our condolences to the families and victims who had to relive the pain and horrors of the senseless, unjustified, and illegal executions of their loved ones. In particular, we'd like to extend our condolences to Colette Flanagan, who we heard this morning, Philanese Floyd, and Gwen Carr. Their loved ones and the loved ones of all of the victims that we have heard testimonies of, they fell at the hands of the police here in the United States. The same police who are sworn to serve and protect and instead served as executioners of our children and of our loved ones, and who will, in all instances, the victims were unarmed or posing no threat or serious bodily harm to the police or to any third persons. And in the words of one of the family members whose testimony we heard, the only weapon that they had was the color of their skin. We also extend our thanks and appreciation to the 12 commissioners, some of whom are on this panel today, representing international experts from Africa, Asia, Europe, Latin America, and the Caribbean. We thank them for taking time from their busy professional activities to dedicate time to reviewing witness statements, presiding over hearings, and listening to the heart-wrenching testimonies of the victims' families, and then preparing their findings and recommendations. We thank our four rapporteurs who helped in the coordination of the testimony of the witness during the hearings and introduced the witnesses to the commissioners and assisted the commissioners in preparing their report. We thank our outreach staff who reviewed hundreds of cases of the unjustified killings of Black men and women in the United States. And because of constraints of time, we were only able to select 44 cases of the most egregious cases for our hearings. These cases represent only the tip of the iceberg of the systemic nature of the pandemic of racist police violence against people of African descent in the United States. These cases were gathered from all around the United States, from the Northeast, from the Southeast, from the Northwest, Southwest, Central states, 20 states in all, and 33 cities across the United States. And the cases spanned 20 years, as we heard. The cities were large, the cities were small. We heard testimony of the variety of methods used by the police in their killings. All of these killings were malicious and intentional of unarmed Black men, Black women, and trans and gender non-conforming Black people across the United States. The victims were shot. They were tortured with tasers inflicting 50,000 volts of electricity into the bodies of people suffering from mental illness. Some of the witnesses were suffocated. Some were choked to death. Others were killed when the police used their very vehicles as weapons of lethal weapons. In all cases, the victims were unarmed. I would be amiss if I did not thank my fellow members of the steering committee who spent the last 10 months working and preparing the report that you will be hearing today. The International Delegation of Jurists, the genesis of this International Commission of Inquiry was inspired by the petition of Paul Robeson and William Paterson, who in 1951 filed a petition at the United Nations entitled, "We Charge Genocide in the Crimes of the US Government Against the Negro People." The predecessor to this international commission today was a commission that was a petition that was filed in 1978 by the National Conference of Black Lawyers, the National Alliance Against Racist and Political Repression, and the United Church of Christ. And they filed that petition on Human Rights Day in December 1978. In support of that petition, they assembled the International Association of Democratic Lawyers, assembled a international delegation of jurists from Africa, Asia, Europe, Latin America, and the Caribbean to travel to the United States, visit prisons across the United States, talk to prisoners in these various states, and prepare their report. Today, the findings and recommendations of our International Commission of Inquiry into Systemic Racist Police Violence Against People of African Descent filed our report with the United Nations Office of the High Commissioner of Human Rights on March 30th of 2021.
The International Commission of Inquiry was organized by the National Conference of Black Lawyers, the International Association of Democratic Lawyers, and the National Lawyers Guild. Visit inquirycommission.org to view the 188-page document. Clarence Thomas, the past Secretary Treasurer of ILWU Local 10 in San Francisco, has been a fighter against police murders and for his union. He spoke to Pacifica producer Steve Zeltzer.
I think that, you know, for ILWU members, we have a history that we can learn and draw from. Specifically in 1934, July 5th, is a date that is commemorated by longshore workers on the West Coast. It's called Bloody Thursday, because on that day during the West Coast waterfront strike on July 5th, 1934, two strikers were killed. One was a longshore worker and the other one was a member of the Marine Cooks and Stewart. They both were shot in the back by the police. So our members understand the relationship between the police and the state. Those killings prompted a general strike in San Francisco that lasted for a duration of 4 days, paralyzing the entire city. We understand that relationship. A lot of white members of the working class, they have a hard time connecting those dots because they view the police entirely different than what the black community views the police. I used to be in the Black Panther Party back in the late 60s, and Huey Newton described the police department as being an occupying force in the community. The police department is there not to protect and serve the community, it's to protect and serve property, the rich, and the state, and for social control over the Black population. So I think that that's one of the advantages that the ILWU members can draw from. I think that one of the things that people in the United States and all over the world have been able to see is that the relationship between capitalism and the police. First of all, the police represent the ruling class. When the police kill Black people with no kind of accountability, that emanates from the fact of the role of the police in the United States of America. That role emanates from the slave catchers. White police officers don't view Black people in the same way as they view whites. And so their whole perception of encounters with the community is entirely different. We've witnessed whites who have murdered scores of people and the police arrest them as if they were taking them in for running a red light. Whereas Black people, they can be Black men, women, or children, are indiscriminately shot down because the police said, I thought they had a gun. But one of the things that many of the whites who have been in the streets protesting, they understand that their future is very dim. Their future is dim because of the lack of opportunities that are presented to the working class, to whites, even the middle class today. There are no jobs. There is no national living wage. There's a lack of affordable housing. I was talking to a longshore worker just the other day who's also a real estate broker. He said that the average longshore worker can't afford to live in Oakland, let alone live in San Francisco. The wages are too low. But people are beginning to understand the, I guess you could say, the interrelationship between race and class. And that's a real eye opener. I was really shocked to see the number of whites that were in the street. It's not just the question of police terror. It also has to do with the whole question of capitalism. Young people are very enthusiastic to critique capitalism. Unlike many of our generation, Steve, who came up during the formation of the national security state, socialism scares them. It's a boogeyman. Ooh. You know, young people can critique socialism, critique capitalism because they're the ones that are working in Amazon. Many of them have degrees. They're the ones that are working in the gig economy, holding two or three jobs. So they're understanding the relationship between race and class. And I think that's a very, very important thing. I would just like to say this. I think that ILWU Local 10 has been one of the few unions in the United States, if not the world, that has continued to draw upon its radical history and tradition and to demonstrate to the working class what it needs to do in order to address these issues. Let's take, for an example, Juneteenth of 2020. What happened on that day? Well, all 29 ports on the West Coast, including Vancouver, British Columbia, shut down for 8 hours to commemorate Juneteenth. Also, to call for an end to systemic racism, police terror, and the privatization of the Port of Oakland. The idea that a baseball owner would hold the city hostage to say, we're going to leave the city if you don't give us 120 acres where the Oakland Coliseum and the Oracle Arena are located, if you don't give us 55 acres of the Port of Oakland, if you don't give us $1 billion in a tax relief for infrastructure. In 2019, they said it was going to be $200 million. It's escalated now to $1 billion. They want to create an inner city for the rich at the port. So, you know, all of these things are happening. ILWU Local 10 is on the front line. It's no accident that longshore workers are some of the most militant workers in the world. And one of the reasons for that is that we understand that the cargo does not become merchandise until it's taken off the ship. So we understand capitalism very well. We understand that the only reason why we enjoy the benefits that we do from our employers is because they know that if they don't pay us a fair wage, the ship will not sail on time, that cargo will not be unloaded. We have tremendous power at the point of production, and we're not at all reluctant to exercise that power.
Clarence Thomas, past secretary, treasurer of ILWU Local 10 in San Francisco. This is COVID, Race, and Democracy. I'm Akua Holt. 100 years ago, on May 31st, 1921, in the Greenwood District of Tulsa, Oklahoma, an armed mob terrorized and destroyed the African-American community for 2 days. Three esteemed African-American elders who survived the massacre testified before the House Judiciary Committee on May 19, 2021. Ms. Viola Fletcher, her brother, Hughes Van Ellis, also known as Uncle Red, and Ms. Lessing Benningfield Randall vividly described how their entire communities were destroyed by lawless white mobs. Attorney B.C. Franklin, the father of historian John Hope Franklin, wrote, "The sidewalk was literally covered with burning turpentine balls."
My name is Viola Ford Fletcher. I'm the daughter of Lucinda Ellis and John Wesley Ford of Tulsa, Oklahoma. I'm the sister of Hughes Van Ellis, who is also here today. I'm a survivor of the Tulsa Race Massacre. 2 weeks ago, I celebrated my 107th birthday. Today, I'm visiting Washington, D.C. for the first time in my life. I'm here seeking justice, and I'm asking my country to acknowledge what happened in Tulsa in 1921. On May 31st in 21, I went to bed in my family's home in Greenwood, neighbors of Tulsa. The neighborhood I felt asleep in that night was rich, not just in terms of wealth, but in culture, community, heritage, and my family had a beautiful home. We had great neighbors, and I had friends to play with. I felt safe. I had everything a child could need. I had a bright future ahead of me. Still, Greenwood should have given me the chance to truly make it in this country. Within a few hours, all of that was gone. The night of the massacre, I was awakened by my family. My parents and 5 siblings were there. I was told we had to leave, and that was it. I will never forget the violence of the white mob when we left our home. I still see black men seeing being shot, black bodies lying in the street. I still smell smoke and see fire. I still see black businesses being burned. I still hear airplanes flying overhead. I hear the screams. I have lived through the massacre every day. Our country may forget this history, but I cannot. I will not. And other survivors do not, and our descendants do not. When my family was forced to leave Tulsa, I lost my chance of an education. I never finished school past the 4th grade. I have never made much money in my country. State and city took a lot from me. Despite this, I spent time supporting the war effort in the shipyards of California. But most of my life, I was a domestic worker serving white families. I never made much money, but to this day, I can barely afford my everyday needs. We lost everything that day, our homes, our churches, our newspapers, our theaters, our lives. Greenwood represented all the best of what was possible for black people in America and for all the people. No one cared about us for almost 100 years. We and our history have been forgotten, washed away. This Congress must recognize us and our history. For black America, for the white Americans, and for all Americans, with that's some justice. Is that it? Thank you.
Mother Fletcher, if we don't learn from history, we're doomed to repeat it. So thank you for putting us on the right course to learn and to understand and to do better.
Thank you.
Are you the older of the two siblings?
The older.
Are you older than Mr. than your brother here?
Yes.
You are?
Yes.
So he's used to having a tough act to follow. Our next witness is Mr. Hughes Van Ellis, known as Uncle Red.
Yep.
He's a World War II veteran, having served the United States Army in the China-Burma-India Theater of Operations as a member of an all-black unit. He's also a survivor of the Tulsa Race Massacre. Uncle Red, you're on.
Chairman Gorman, Ranking Member Johnson, and member of the subcommittee. My name is Hughes Van Ellis. I am 100 years old, and I am a survivor of the Tulsa Race Massacre. Do you believe in the promise of America and the pieces of freedom? I did my duty in World War II. I served in combat in the Far East with the 234 AAA Gun Battalion. We were all black battalion. I fought for freedom aboard, even though it was ripped away from me at home. Even after my home and my community were destroyed, it's because I believe in the end, America would get its right. When I returned home from the war, I didn't find any of this freedom. I was fighting for overseas. Unlike white servicemen, I wasn't entitled to GI Bill benefits because of the color of my skin. I came home to segregation, a separate an unequal America, but still I believed in America. This is why we are still speaking up today. Even at this age of 100, the Tulsa Race Massacre is a footnote in the history books for us. We live with it every day. And the thought of what Greenwood was and what it could have been. We aren't just black and white pictures on a screen. We are flesh and blood. I was there when it happened.
It was like a war. White men with guns came and destroyed my community. We couldn't understand why. What did we do to them? We didn't understand. We were just living, but they came and they destroyed everything. They burned houses and businesses. They just took what they wanted and out of the building. Then they burned the building. They murdered people. We were told they just dumped the dead bodies into the river. I remember running outside of our house. I just passed dead bodies. It wasn't a pretty sight. I still see it today in my mind, 100 years later. I was so scared. I didn't think we could make it out to alive. I remember people were running everywhere. We waited for the soldiers to come. And when they finally came, they took us to the fairground where we would be saved. It felt like so long before they came. I survived the 1921 Tulsa Race Massacre, and I have survived 100 years of painful memories and losses. By the grace of God, I am still here. The white people who did this to us were filled with so much hate. It is disgusting that they hate us for no reason except that we are Black people. We know most of the people who committed these acts are dead now. The three of us here today are the only ones left that we know of. But just because these men are probably dead, the city and county of Tulsa, the state of Oklahoma, and the Tulsa Chamber are still responsible for making it right, because it was they who caused the massacre. And it's continued on.
Elders Viola Fletcher, her brother Hughes Van Ellis, also known as Uncle Rudd, and Lessie Benningfield Randall testified before the House Judiciary Subcommittee May 19, 2021. The Washington Post reports all three survivors are seeking reparations for themselves and their descendants in a lawsuit filed in 2020 against Tulsa, Tulsa County, the state, and the Tulsa Chamber of Commerce. The City Police Department and the County Sheriff's Office deputized and armed white Tulsans to murder, loot, and burn the nearly 40 city blocks of the Greenwood District, according to the reparations lawsuit. The state National Guard participated with the mob in killing and looting and destroying the property of Black residents of Greenwood. The city, sheriff, chamber, and county targeted Black community leaders and victims of the massacre for prosecution as instigators of the massacre, despite knowing who were truly responsible. Listen no more often to things than to beings. My name is Tobe Chukwu Dubemwigwe. I'm an Igbo boy from the southwest side of Houston, Texas. Wake up, everybody. No more sleeping in bed. No more backwards thinking. Time for thinking ahead. The world has changed so very much from what it used to be. There is so much hatred, war, and poverty. Cause they're the ones who's coming up, and the world is in their hands. So when you teach the children, teach them the very best you can. Everybody's new, the world won't get no better if you just let it be. The world won't get no better. We gotta change it, yeah.
We gotta change it.
You and me. This concludes our special edition of COVID Race and Democracy. We thank all Pacifica stations and affiliates who contribute to this production. Special thanks to the Pacifica COVID Task Force. You can find this in all previous episodes along with today's playlist at covidtaskforce.pacifica.org. Today's show is produced by Akua Holt and edited by senior producer editor Paulina Vasiliev and Akua Holt. Executive producers are Steve Seltzer, Paulina Vasiliev, and Akua Holt. Thanks for listening. I leave you with this quote. The function of freedom is to free someone else. Toni Morrison. Today's playlist featured Louis Bags, Bald Fist, Sweet Honey, In the Rock, Breaths, Randy Weston, Spirit of Our Ancestors, Toby Degwegwe, Wake Up.